Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mona, there has been a lot of articles, a lot of written news, a lot of newsletters on the increases in the request for evidence, the notices of intent to deny, you know, the RFEs and the NOIDs. It's been going around the news outlets. Of course, there's the power of the pen, and of course, there's the power in the voice. And that's what we're here for on EB5 Investment Voice, to talk about these issues. What's going on, Mona?
Well, I agree with you, Mark. There is a great power of the pen, and everybody knows that for years. But the power of the voice is also coming up strong. So this is a topic which is right at the top and the forefront of practitioners' minds, anyone who really does anything to do with USCIS. But in particular, it's worrisome for EB5, because there have been so many delays and there has been so much going on that suddenly, for an investor who's waited 6, 7, 8 years for adjudication, and or maybe part of adjudication, has invested 6, 7, 8 years ago, and suddenly they receive a NOID, a notice of intention to deny, and it doesn't even seem to be logical, that's a big deal.
Yeah, you're right, Mona. I can definitely see that, because an RFE and a NOID really isn't the news that an investor wants to get after waiting for so long.
There's a lot more to it than that, Mark. And here to discuss today is David Herson from Herson & Associates and my good partner in Gravitas.
Hey, welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you, Mark. A pleasure to be here. And Mona, thanks for the invite for another round.
Well, no one better than you, David. You have not only opinions on this, but you have deep knowledge.
We are facing this issue. It's serious. It's going backwards 10 years. And it's very, very frustrating. Clients are going crazy on it, waiting for these very lengthy delays in adjudication, and then finding that they're digging back to stuff that was previously adjudicated favorably, applying the latest rules to what was done, is being done today versus what was done then, and saying, well, that's the law now. And that just doesn't make any sense. Basic tenet of U.S. jurisprudence is that you don't do retroactive legislation. So that's an initial take.
Oh, well, we have a lot to discuss when it comes to this area, David, I know. But I think just for the listener, those who are perhaps not too familiar with what a request for evidence is or a notice of intention to deny, it's basically when USCIS starts adjudicating cases and starts to see and sees evidence is not completely there. Now, to be really fair, David, there have been a lot of new attorneys coming into the field who haven't really filed petitions correctly with all the evidence that's required under matter of whole. So there are some legitimate requests out there.
Absolutely. There are some very poorly trained attorneys, many of them just utilizing staff and not even looking at the work.
Right.
And that brings about a branding on all attorneys, whereas attorneys who are very careful with their work, understand the law, and respond or file with full details are being treated the same way as if we didn't know what we were doing by people who are still, with due respect, in a training mode.
Well, I think this is what the big issue is. And we just had an article on the same issue, and you commented in that article, David, that USCIS suffered from the great resignation, just like all of us did. This is an industry-wide issue that, you know, staff was lost. But the difference is, this is not something that you can just pick up in a day. EB5 is difficult. EB5 is nuanced. EB5 requires a lot of skill and dedication. I don't think that USCIS have managed to find experienced EB5 people, EB5 practitioners of any sort, to really look at these adjudications. David, don't you think?
Correct. I must disagree with you on this great resignation story during the pandemic. My understanding, and I'm subject to correction, is that USCIS in its wisdom shuffled people around into other divisions and other departments. And that's more frustrating than if these people had resigned. Most of them probably would not have.
Oh, so you're saying that the experienced adjudicators who could have handled EB5 well are now doing other
areas?
That's
almost worse, right? They did it to themselves?
That's my understanding. As I said, from what I've read and a couple of things I've heard, I believe that is the correct situation. Again, subject to correction.
Well, you see, Mark, why we are saying that we think that this is the cause is because, and it's not just David and myself, we're on many different forums and speak to other practitioners within the EB5 community. Across the board, we are seeing naive type of responses. When I say naive, I mean responses which are looking at the boilerplate language of EB5 and really not using any acumen to try and, or experience and to try and see where the issue could really rest. Because with EB5, we're dealing with business, and business is not, does not have straight edges. Every square does not fit into a round hole. And USCIS were really getting good at understanding industry standards, and they were understanding that things can change, the material changes happen, and industry and things within businesses happen. But now, David, you're totally right. We've gone backwards.
They are taking issues on matters that, as I'd said earlier, were clearly dealt with. We'd fought them. Some of them we've even taken into court. We'd won them. We'd got immigration to agree with us on a number of issues. And these things are being revisited as if the officers are looking at the old rules and trying to interpret them themselves, not taking any cognizance of what the cumulative experience was of the whole of immigration in this very complex area. This has always, in my view, been the most complex area of immigration that can be practiced. And in fact, I go so far when I do presentations to suggest people look for every other kind of visa available. If they can't find it, EB5 is an excellent tool, but you have to know how to use it. And then you will rely on an examiner not being properly trained. I don't want to use the word incompetent, but it does happen to come to mind, because they do not show an understanding. When you find the RFEs, the request for evidence, contain questions with these voluminous documents already attached answering all of those questions, that means the person hasn't read it. They're just trying to get a check mark on their sheets to say, I did another case that day and I've met my quota. And that was a big problem that we saw historically. It seemed to settle. You can see by the number of adjudications, they're so low down, even when they were doing the more extreme vetting, there were better numbers of adjudications. So I just feel that this is purely a training issue. You wouldn't have 5 years of delay for I-829s when the statute says 90 days if people would train properly. The I-829 should be relatively straightforward. Prove the jobs were created, prove the money hasn't been paid back, end of story. But they're digging back into the history of the thing so far back that it's just not making any commercial, logical, equitable sense.
Well, I have a question for you, David. Because of the nature of EB5, especially, let's say, take, for example, a project which has perhaps more of an operational slant to it than perhaps straight construction. They always request, and just because of the nature of the particular project, we request things like bank statements, tax returns. Now, these end up being huge, voluminous files. And then you put maybe invoices, general ledgers, as well as construction costs and all whatever else we have. We're talking about massive, massive files now. My problem, which I am seeing, I am feeling, is that there is what's called an information overload. So that USCIS themselves have just too much information and they can't basically see the wood for the trees.
Excellent point. And I agree with you. Now, I know that when you're relying on your revenue and production, that they need to be satisfied that you do have those numbers, but they are easily produced if you get the right certifications. I understand if there's doubt, call for the added backup documents. I've had to give them boxes of information on occasion and agreed that they were right in asking for it. But most times, if you get a certificate from the construction folks or from a CPA who certifies that this is what was spent and this is what is built, the numbers are there. The jobs are created once the numbers are there because you just apply the economic formula. And that was originally done, and you get the economist to recertify that based on the numbers now produced, the jobs are in fact created. They don't have to dig back into issues like source of funds.
No.
It's just crazy to go back and say, well, now you used a money transfer system, which is now no longer acceptable. While it was then acceptable, we're not accepting it now, and we're reversing on your 6 years of waiting and tough luck.
I have a question for you, David. We've mentioned the word RFE, Request for Further Evidence, and NOID, Notice of Intention to Deny. Now, one of the biggest differences between the two is the time you get to respond. With a request for evidence, you get 3 months. With a Notice of Intention to Deny, you get 30 days, which is significant. When should USCIS utilize a NOID, a Notice of Intention to Deny, over an RFE?
Well, I think that most of these issues raised can be cleared up through an RFE, and I don't think they should use it at all, and if so, to use it very rarely to go straight to a NOID. I've seen a few in my time, but there have not been many, so I don't know if this is an endemic problem or if it is something that is starting to arise. What have you seen, Mona? Have you seen a lot of NOIDs straight?
We're seeing more NOIDs. I recall that in one of the public policy discussions, people were saying the same thing, that USCIS is jumping to NOIDs as opposed to RFEs.
Right. Well, as I said, I believe there are appropriate circumstances for that, but they're rare because most of these things can be clarified because it's more a misunderstanding than a non-qualification. That's how I view most of these issues. If the attorneys are competent, and as we said earlier, some are not, but most are, will have filed a case that does qualify. So to go straight to NOID is pretty harsh and draconian, I think is the better word. So I would say they should not go straight to NOID unless it's really an egregious situation.
USCIS have been under a lot of pressure lately to reduce the backlog. Congress has intervened, and we know that they're trying very hard to reduce their backlog. I read a blog piece not so long ago relating to Pool Direct. Pool Direct is no longer the law. And the article referred to the fact that USCIS really didn't care about Pool Direct anymore, and they were just going to have more of a dismissive attitude towards Pool Direct. And we are seeing, for sure, more NOIDs and RFEs relating to those direct type of projects. Do you have opinion on that?
Yes. Why we get on so well, Mona, is because we sometimes disagree. What I've seen here is, yes, there were NOIDs. The one I got was, it was massive NOID. We answered was about 2,500 pages for 21 cases, but they're approving them all now. And basically, I don't think it was a deliberate intent to push indirect direct investment cases back to the back of the line. I think it's just a force of the pressure of the flow of work and some of the systematizing that they could well have done it a little differently. First in, first out is a theory. I don't believe it's practiced. But if they would maintain that, then those direct investments would come up in their due turn, and so they should. Also, many of them are from countries that are not subject to any retrogression or backlog. So there's no reason to push them behind those that are backlogged and then expect to wait the years, for example, for a Chinese case to come up because they filed it later. Apparently, they're trying to do something to alleviate that, but I'm not sure I've seen any of the result of that.
Yeah, but the problem is, David, is that some of the adjudications relating to the direct cases, and there were quite a lot filed during the period that the RCs were closed, the RC program was closed, they really are mixing up, adjudicators are mixing up law relating to regional centers with law relating to direct pooled.
Right. I agree with you on that. We do agree on a lot of stuff, man.
Right. Yeah. Well, so do you have any advice to any of our colleagues out there who are handling these RFEs and NOIDs? Because I do, personally, I get very upset when I see some of these adjudications. I feel strongly for the investor. And I do feel that, you know, the investor has been waiting for years and then you get this nonsense adjudication. So I have a tendency to write in a sarcastic manner. And perhaps, you know, that's not advised.
Well, my advice on this is write your most sarcastic, cutting response that you can. Put it away until tomorrow. Come back, clean out all of that stuff, and go back as a professional attorney dealing with the issues and not with any emotions. Because if you start with emotions, you get emotions back, and they'll be looking to find anything they can to deny you. There's no point in it. It just makes you, the author, feel a little better for a moment, but there's no benefit to the client.
That's very good advice, David.
Hard to follow, but really good advice.
I would like to point out that, as you mentioned, David, there are unmotivated adjudicators out there just looking to fill their quotas. I would like to point out just what kind of devastating consequences a denial, let's take a denial of a NOID, sorry, a denial of an I-829. At the I-829 stage, especially after all of these delays, we're looking at someone who's invested maybe 8 years ago, maybe longer, and who perhaps have their family in the United States, who've got a life now in the United States. To receive a denial after so many years, it's absolutely heartbreaking and devastating for that particular person.
You're absolutely right. I don't think that many of the immigration officers see the family, the emotion, and the seriousness of what they're dealing with. They see it as they go around for a drink after work and say, you know how many I managed to deny today? Wow, I'm doing well at my job. And that I've heard spoken about as well, sort of out of school, but it's the kind of thing that they get some level of pleasure, unfortunately, out of denying, because they feel in their own way justifying it as they're really doing their jobs well. If they were approving, they're not doing their jobs.
I really wish we could put more about the humanitarian aspect of it. For example, families where child might age out, and how that child would ever be able to gain access. Families where they have no other option. Perhaps they've actually lost their investment, and or they're not going to get their investment back, and or they wouldn't have the money to reinvest into another petition. And they have no other option but the EB-5.
Right.
There's so many stories out there. There are people who've used their savings they've borrowed from their grandparents, their father's 401k money, all kinds of things. And when adjudicators just walk over them, as I said, it's heartbreaking.
Right. Well, we do have a small advantage in the fact that the denial is not a final denial, and they can keep renewing the conditional resident status until you get in front of an immigration law judge.
Well, that's one point I was going to ask you about. So a USCIS do not have the authority to take away somebody's green card, correct?
In this instance, you're correct, unless there's fraud, and then they'll go back to the beginning and deny the whole case. They'll withdraw or deny the original I-526. I think there may be some basis for them to do it. Not likely, but I would rather look at the situation of getting it in front of that administrative law judge. Because now you have an ability to explain everything to the judge and show the good faith of the investors, the full intent, the compliance with the spirit of the law to the nth degree, and the fact that it failed not being that investor's fault. And I'm told that some of the judges actually listen to this and will approve the removal of the conditions. There are, of course, as there are in any professions, those who have a total anti-immigrant basis for their thinking, and they will deny whatever they can as well. So we're then into the more appellate division with the BIA and maybe on to federal court. But it's heartbreaking. It's very expensive. It leaves people with all of this uncertainty, certainly not good for the mind. People will freak out over this, understandably.
Well, they get put into removal proceedings. That's why. And removal proceedings can also be delayed for years and years. Yes, I do believe also that immigration judges have a lot more ability to listen to the case and really look at something, look at a case in more of a independent mind and more realistic mind, which I don't think USCIS are doing. I think USCIS are just living in a bubble and they just don't see business realities at times. However, I don't see too many investors waiting around to go through the whole of the removal proceedings. And there isn't any appeal when it comes to the denial of a 829.
Correct. You have to go through the immigration law judge for a hearing. So what immigration are supposed to do on their denial is to issue a notice to appear to the individual. And that's something that doesn't seem to necessarily follow. There's been long breaks and sometimes never got a notice to appear.
Yeah, see that those sort of thing. And then somebody, if an investor doesn't have any status in the country, that's not helpful either. Although technically their green card is renewed every year.
Right.
Technically.
I would like to see a situation where immigration get a little pressure. It's been decided that it won't work, but if you do your 5 years and you qualify for U.S. citizenship naturalization application, file it and get in front of a court who can then make some determinations on the whole of the case. But they've somehow blocked that, obviously in their own interests, so they don't get forced to make adjudications quicker than they want to.
Well, going back to giving advice to our fellow colleagues, David, do you advise when you see a case, even if it hasn't been adjudicated, that we should interfile, perhaps interfile information relating to jobs, information relating to the actual business activities, perhaps anything negative, just to avoid a possible RFE or annoyed?
That's a judgment call on the facts of each case. There are occasions when it's absolutely warranted and other occasions when I think you'll trigger a series of events that may not have happened, but for your interfiling, therefore you should not have interfiled because it's an issue that might be so esoteric that the officer doesn't notice it and you get your approval. Whereas once you put it before them, they start digging and finding reasons to actually issue the RFE. So I would be very cautious on the facts of the case before interfiling, but interfiling can be a useful tool if your interfiling actually gets to the file, and that's another issue.
Yeah, well, yeah. That was an issue before with all those boxes that they lost during COVID. I would say again, David, that it is really, really important if you're doing EB-5, whether you're doing your own petition or whether you're in a regional center petition, that you have counsel who understands how EB-5 works and what to look at in the documents.
Right. Just to go back to interfiling for a moment, one of the issues that immigration tries rigorously to enforce is that you didn't file it in the initial filing, therefore you can't bring it about now. As I understand it, that only applies if it's new events. If the events were in existence and the documents were there and were just omitted, to my understanding that you can still interfile them and they can't take that point, although they regularly do.
Well, whether or not it's a material change or not, is that what you're referring to?
No, it's more a question of whether the information supporting what you're now saying was available prior to filing and was just not included. In other words, it's not new information. It's additional pre-existing information. And then they take the point, well, it wasn't filed at the time of the filing.
Well, what about a situation whereby somebody has, an investor has invested in a hotel project? The hotel project itself hasn't started construction or any operations, mainly because at the time of filing, the closing wasn't done. And there was a full letter of intent and a mortgage, a letter from the bank for the mortgage, etc. But the actual closing doesn't take place until well after the investors filed. And then the attorney interfiles the actual closing and the along with the deed. Would you say that fell under that category?
That would fall into a category of just bringing them up to speed of what you said would happen so that when they get to the case, they can see it in fact happened. Because all of the business plans and the financials that are given are prospective. And there's no assurance you're going to get it done in the time stated. That is usual business. We know that many projects get substantially delayed. There are even a few that finish early. But basically, delay is more than norm. And if something has now come through, which you said would happen, and it has happened, I would interfile that so that the officer, if they get to see it, will know that, yes, you have, in fact, done the foundations and started with the concrete and the whole thing is being built rather than it's still in this open question of whether it's done or not.
So, David, I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question next. And I have my opinions on this. What can USCIS do to improve themselves? And do not say fire everybody.
No, I wouldn't say that because then we'd be back to where we were a couple of years ago with new people being hired. So I would take those that are there and I would ensure that they get fully trained. I would try to bring in, and we had this many years ago with the Western Service Center, which is now a California Service Center. We were brought in as a group and they gave us some name like the Tiger Group or something. And we trained the officers about our experience as practitioners.
Oh, and wow.
A completely different practical perspective. We weren't there to mislead them. We were there to tell them what is going on, which they'd never see behind the walls of the Ziggurat building in Laguna. This brought to their attention the practicalities, and it did make a difference, unfortunately, only for a while.
Well, you know, David, back in 2011 or 2012, we were putting a regional center together with a new economist who really did not have an understanding of EB5 in the same way. So we had a big problem with the economic report, and we were going back and forth with RFEs. USCIS actually invited us to come in and discuss the case with them so that they could flesh out what the problem was. That was amazing. We got the case approved and we understood where USCIS were coming from. It was the one and only time I went into the USCIS offices to discuss this. But I felt that this is so warranted. And I feel like something like this is warranted anytime USCIS is going to deny at the 829 stage. I would love to see in-person meetings.
Absolutely agree with you on that. There was a time when it was actually in their operating procedures that they could call in for a discussion about the cases. Not many people got called. There were some. This is the basis of any business and negotiations, communication. If you can have clear communication, you'll get the result.
You bring up a good point, David. You can't get clear communication with filing these cases and then something is dug up. I mean, it would be great to hop on a conference call or even just a direct phone call with somebody to find out what they want, what they're looking for.
You need to look at, is it possible to get a meeting with them to sit down and talk? Up until 15 years ago, I had an ability to pick up the phone and speak to all the way up to the director of the service center. And they would listen to me and they would look to be as helpful as possible within the parameters of what was going on. And there is nothing untoward. And there was none of the stuff that they've passed all this legislation for where people were trying to get advantages. But we discussed the merits and we come to a conclusion. And I can tell you up until 10 plus years ago, I never filed a lawsuit against immigration. Once they put up these walls and they wouldn't allow us to talk to them and you couldn't communicate, suddenly I had a slew of mandamus actions and we also had a number of actual lawsuits on the bad decisions. These could have all been avoided with communication.
Wow, that is, if there's one word, Mark, that we can take away from this podcast, it's that, communication.
Communication, exactly.
I would love it to be able to get out there, David. Do you think we should write an open letter to USCIS?
Yes, there's no harm in it. I would love it to get to Secretary of Homeland Security, because when he headed USCIS and he would come to the EB5 meetings, he understood business. He was open. He would make decisions on issues that were practical, and so much moved forward under his leadership. Although there was some political issue that went in on the side, which I knew a lot about, and it was purely political spin to try and derail him. He was a straight arrow. He did the right thing, and he made things move forward practically. We would have 20, 30 people in an office with him, and he'd take every question, and he'd genuinely discuss each item with them. And if he didn't agree and he thought it was inappropriate, he would say so, and we wouldn't get it. It wasn't as if we asked and got. We got discussion, again, communication, and the results were phenomenal. I mean, the one thing I keep remembering him saying, it's the money that creates the jobs. So if you do the it's the project that creates the job. So the money doesn't have to be shown directly going to a specific job. It goes to the project and the jobs get created. Hence, the underlying real estate is part of the project. Even if it doesn't create any jobs, it's still acceptable that you pay for your real estate in a development with EB5 money, as long as the rest of the money creates the necessary number of jobs. So this was something he was so clear on, and it was so negative from immigration at the time that this totally switched, and it made a big difference to practice.
David, I really couldn't agree more. These are words of wisdom, but born from years and years of experience. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, and I really enjoyed putting my thoughts together with you, and hopefully some impact will be had on the USCIS side, and they will see that there are other ways to do things.